Welcome back, everybody, to episode 3 of The Wildly Unexplained. I'm Gary.
And I'm Danny. What's up, Gary? We got a lot to unpack this time.
Yes, we do. Today's episode, we're actually going to break it down for y'all. We're going to actually really kind of, we're going to peel back the layers here for most of these cases that David Politz has kind of pulled together for us. And we're going to kind of see, you know, what some of the major points are to make them a definable case for Polide's research.
Exactly. Yeah, these cases, I believe, he's got a certain criteria or profile points that he likes to refer to. And, you know, we're going to go down those profile points and show you what makes these cases so bizarre and how they stand out from other missing persons cases.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just to kind of notate to that, you know, there are specific characteristics about some of these cases that do come up, you know, where Dave, he really kind of separates them out. And it's very interesting, you know, just with the research that, you know, that you've done, Danny, and, you know, compiling everything that we've brought in, there's just so much, you know, so many different characteristics out there. And honestly, there are some generic ones too that, you know, people could just kind of speculate, you know, that, oh yes, it was this, it was that. But realistically speaking, you know, Polides actually has a lot of thresholds that have to be met in order for him to actually investigate these cases, which, in my opinion, you know, kind of really gives it a lot more credibility, one, but it makes it that much more interesting because he's not just, you know, succumbing to, you know, the generic, you know, motive intent, you know, behind whatever these cases are.
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, when people hear about missing persons cases in the wild, they're like, you know, people go in the wild, they disappear, it happens. But when you see how we differentiate these cases from the others, you'll see that they're not easily explainable by a few different reasons.
Yeah, no, and it's absolutely crazy, you know, to kind of think about that. But in any sense, let's dive in, because I'm super fired up about this. I'm really excited to kind of break this, you know, break down the cases for us, you know, for us and the listeners here. So the first thing I wanted to kind of talk about in today's episode was the cases that actually don't fit the profile points, and Polides actually does not include in the investigation. So,
which I think are very interesting and important that we cover these before we get into the profile points.
Yeah, for sure. So the first thing on there is animal predation. So like you said earlier, you know, when you hear about, you know, a missing hiker, a missing hunter, you know, something to that kind of nature, what, you know, in a national park or wherever, you know, you're thinking, okay, animal got him, you know, for sure, you know, he's gone. End the story. Like, that's that.
Yeah, and that typically is what a lot of people link to whenever these people go missing and vanish. You know, well, probably a mountain lion or a bear got them.
Yeah.
But the problem with that being the case, animal predation cases, typically they're very gruesome and they leave a lot of evidence behind.
Right, and that's one of the things that, you know, most of these missing 401 cases don't have is evidence. You know,
right.
So with the animal predation case, you know, yes, it's very gruesome, but more often than not, you can find tracks, you can find, you know, again, evidence to, you know, to fully support that this was an animal predation case, you know?
Yeah. There's blood, there's scraps of clothing, there's tracks, you know, and typically these people sometimes vanish nearby other people. So, and in the instances that they go missing, you don't actually hear these people screaming in agony. You know, if an animal or a mountain lion grabs you by the neck, you're going to scream in pain.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and even, you know, living out here in Colorado, I mean, you know, we recently had, you know, a hiker that actually got attacked by a mountain lion. You know, fortunately, this person survived.
Yeah, I recall hearing about that case.
Yeah, very, very strange and very wild, honestly. You know, very, very scary. But, you know, again, you know, you're going to hear that sort of stuff if you're in the area, you know.
Right.
But if you're not, you know, again, like we've been saying, you're going to find the evidence to support, okay, this was definitely an animal predation case.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
So next on the list is mental health issues and suicidal intent. So, I mean, again, I want to circle back, you know, with the animal predation case, like there's evidence. There's very clear evidence to what the, you know, what the intent was, or, you know, the background and everything. You know, so as far as like mental health issues and suicidal intent, I mean, I kind of chalk this up to, you know, if a person has, you know, mental health history, that's going to be recorded. You know,
yeah.
if they have a history of depression, you know, or if there's, you know, more mental stuff going on than maybe meets the eye, there's more than likely going to be some sort of, you know, history with that. There's going to be some sort of recording to really, you know, base that evidence off of. And the suicidal intent, I mean, if someone's going out there to commit, you know, to commit suicide, they're going to eventually find the body, you know, or at least find, you know, the bones if it's years afterwards. But, you know,
and typically they're going to leave evidence that, you know, they wanted to leave this earth. And maybe their family were privy to the fact that they had suicidal tendencies. So these types of cases, they're more easily explained, and that's why they're not involved in our criteria.
Right, right. And so the next on the list, the person deliberately wanted to walk away from their life and not be found. So, I mean, again, so a little bit more of a tricky scenario. You know, you've got somebody who just legitimately does not want to be in their life any longer, you know, wants to, you know, essentially fake their own death, you know, and just get themselves out of whatever situation they're in currently. You know, this to me is a little bit more tricky because the intent here is to baffle, you know, whoever is going to be searching for you, you know, and to make it appear like you've literally just disappeared, much like the missing 411 cases.
Right. And if there's any inkling that these people wanted to leave their current lives, you know, then these cases would not make it onto our profiles.
Right, absolutely. And that's one of the biggest points too. And that's where, you know, that bullet point right there kind of makes it a little bit more sticky, you know, to kind of think about it. You know, because look at the Mel Nadell case, you know, where we kind of dove into that last episode.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that one was just like, it was crazy. You know, because the guy was, I mean, avid hunter, you know, everything to, kept himself in good shape. And, you know, I mean, he did have a hurt ankle or hurt foot, you know, but he still, like, he had a great life, you know, from what it seems on the outside. But then it kind of leads, you know, it leads me to think, you know, hey, what if, you know, I mean, you ever heard of the adage, you know, you don't judge a book by its cover?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that makes me think of that adage. I mean, and so where it's like, you know, on the outside, this guy had it all. Had a great job, had a loving family, you know, had a daughter he loved so much. But was he really, like, happy? And that kind of, like, brings some questions to me, you know, and for this bullet point, you know, did he just not want to be found? But then it also poses a question for me. How?
Right. When you look at the case we covered and the evidence of the blind and the tracks, it just, if he did manage to just walk away from his life and never be found, he did a great job, almost an excellent job in doing so.
I'd say it was damn near perfect. I mean,
yeah.
No one's found him. I mean, the dude is long gone. You know, if he did in fact, you know, just decide to up and leave, I mean, he's long gone, dude.
Yeah,
this dude perfected, you know, not being found. You know, not only by, you know, exactly just like stifling, you know, the search and rescue animals and the searchers themselves, but everybody. I mean, everyone included in the effort. I mean, just baffled.
Does not make sense to me at all.
No. But in any sense, the next on the list, and I'm going to combine these two because I think
foul
that
play.
Foul play, and then also drowning. You know, you're gonna come up with some sort of evidence to, you know, to base your facts on. You know, foul play, crime. You know, obviously there's going to be intent there. There's going to be evidence to support this, you know, everything that kind of goes with it. Drowning, same thing, you know.
Doesn't necessarily evidence of a kidnapping.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and as far as drowning goes, not necessarily intent, could have slipped and fallen, hit their head, something to that kind of nature. But you're going to find the body, you're going to find, you know, some sort of evidence as to what they were doing, you know, prior to, you know, slipping and falling or, you know, just essentially drowning. You know, so All of those profile points are what, you know, Politis used to essentially weed out most of the cases that he's taken on, you know?
Right.
So he uses, like, these characteristics and, like, these profile points to say, okay, well, that's, you can essentially explain that one, you know, as opposed to most of the ones that he's covered, you know, where it's, all right, well, we still don't even know where this dude is, you know, his tracks stop 150 feet from the, or 150 yards from the campsite. nowhere to be seen. No evidence to support he was even here, aside from the missing footprint or the for the footprints and the tracks, and you know, just bizarre.
Yeah, and if you look at a lot of these missing persons cases, you can jot up to any one of these profile points that we just covered. You know, most of them can be explained to one of these points right here.
Yeah, and you know, that's to me like kind of what makes things a little bit more intriguing and makes me want to kind of do a little bit more digging on our own, is the fact that they are such a, like, they're so bizarre. You know, like the disappearances and everything like that. I mean, even look at, you know, little Keith from last episode. You know, 3 years old, you know, walks essentially 12 miles, you know, on his own, through the dark, you know, through the really thick, you know, bush and everything like that, and ends up, you know, with his jacket to his side, you know, face down in the snow, alive, miraculously. But yeah, it's just so weird.
Yeah, that was a weird case for sure, man.
Super weird. But in any sense, let's get into the beefy stuff. So let's hit the actual case profile points. I really want to kind of break this one down a little bit further.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of points. I believe some of them are more important than others, but David Politis did a really good job documenting these different profile points and how they link up to the missing 411 profile. There's a lot of them. Some of them are more important than others, but let's get right into them, man.
Yeah, 100%, man. So roughly, you know, across the board here, there's about 640 million acres of federal land.
Yeah,
so,
which is a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. So Politis has actually found 59 clusters, and that number's continuously grown across the board over the years. So yeah, 59 clusters, and we'll define clusters in a minute here, but just think about that. 59 clusters across the board over 640 million acres of federal land. That number is wild.
Yeah, and like you said, that number has gone up over the years with all the cases he's looked into. You know, they just keep going up in number.
Yeah, I mean, just unexplained phenomenon. And it's again, just wild. So, a cluster. So for an area to actually qualify as a cluster, there has to be at least four cases for it to fit the profile. So again, so I want to reiterate here, he's found 59 clusters over the 640 million acres of federal land.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. To me, like, that's insane. I mean, you know, just doing the math here, you know, four cases per cluster, that's 236 cases, you know, across the board, you know, in the span of that. Of Dave actually doing the research on this. Who knows how much, you know, how many more there are?
Yeah, when you look into these clusters, you know, the bigger clusters have very large amounts of people going missing. So when you look at the cluster map, you can find it online. It's insane how many missing people are in these just concentrated areas across our lands.
Yeah, it's baffling to me, honestly. But you know, some of these locations that actually, you know, are more high profile, like spots where Politis has actually researched: Yosemite in California, Crater Lake in Oregon, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, and actually the Rocky Mountain National Park right in my backyard in Colorado. Yeah. So those are actually some of the more high profile hotspots. You know, where the largest clusters are actually located.
Yeah, exactly. And these are very large parks, but when you look at these general areas and you look for missing persons cases in these national parks, you can see just the large group of people that have gone missing in these areas, and a lot of them fit our profile.
Yeah, and it's very scary. Very, very scary. But most of the people who actually go missing out in these national parks are around, they're located, you know, either near or around large bodies of water or boulder fields, which is kind of strange, because it kind of like, you know, narrows it down to obviously like two locations, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just national parks, and that's not to really say that, you know, that's always going to be the case, because I, you know, there's no guarantees in life, you know, aside from death and taxes.
Yeah, well, these large bodies of water and boulder fields, those might seem like trivial at first, but when you look at the cases and how many times people are generally found around these areas, it just kind of keeps popping back at you. So that's why we thought it was worth mentioning.
Yeah, it's 100% accurate. And another really kind of weird thing to kind of notate here is the atmospheric events that that take place, either during the disappearance or during the search and rescue efforts. So it's either before or after the person goes missing.
Yeah, because I recall there are some cases where people say that they got separated from the person who went missing, and all of a sudden the weather changed. Also, during the search and rescue effort, sometimes these atmospheric events come in and they disrupt the rescue efforts. Just like Mel Nadel's case, if you recall, they had to call off the search for a whole day because of a storm that came in.
And actually, like, they almost got like severely injured, if memory serves.
Yeah, but I mean, when you look at it, is it bad luck? Is it something else? But it seems to happen a lot in these cases.
Yeah, and it's wild. So going back to the Tom Messick case, do you recall when the search and rescue dogs were actually sent out?
Yeah, I remember that one.
So
That one, our
our
case.
next point here, so our search and rescue dogs, I mean, these are like highly trained, their skill level for finding people, and that is their sole duty, is to go out there, pick up a scent, and find whoever they're looking for, right?
Yeah.
So most of the in a lot of these cases, the search and rescue dogs are unable to pick up a scent, and if they do, they follow to a few feet and then begin acting bizarrely. So they'll actually circle and then sit down. So
Yeah.
I'm not sure about you, but I don't know any sort of search and rescue canine that has that behavior. In a case where you're looking for a missing person, the dog just kind of picks up a scent, follows it, and is like, all right, you know what? This is a good spot to sit down. I'm gonna take a break.
Yeah, it almost makes sense when you look at some of these cases where, the trail leads to a certain spot and then just completely vanishes, almost as if the person just was plucked out of the sky. That
Right.
makes sense why dogs, they're just baffled and they can't seem to find track of these people, and they just automatically stop at one point of the search.
Well, and when these SAR dogs are called in, studies have actually shown that they have a 76% success rate in the field. I mean,
Yeah.
that is a high number. Like that's not like a, oh, we've got a 15% success rate here, and hopefully we'll find this person. No, that's 76% success rate.
Oh, they're very effective at what they do,
That's
and
crazy.
time and time again, we see in these cases, they're not so effective.
Right. Well, and again, going back to Mel Nadel, his footprints actually went 150 yards, so about a football field and a half away from the camp, right?
Yeah.
So if they go 150 yards away from the camp into the forest, mind you, and dogs pick up his scent, pick up his tracks and everything, they get out there to that 150 yard mark, and they're like, all right, well, this is where it ends. He should be here.
Yeah, but that's
And
typically not
no
the
Mel.
case. Yeah,
No
the
Mel.
dogs, they're not very efficient, and we see it time and time again, these cases, it's pretty bizarre to me.
It's insane, is what it is. I mean, so I'm just kind of sitting here, just kind of thinking about this, and thinking about these dogs and everything, and like I said earlier, in this bullet point, I mean, they're trained literal professionals
Yeah.
to go out there, find the scent, find any sort of tracks that you can for this person, and find them.
Yeah, and search and rescue holds these dogs in high regard. They're a very valuable tool out in the field, and most often than not, in these bizarre cases, they're not doing what they're supposed to. They can't seem to find traces of these people.
I mean, they can't.
No.
It's not that they aren't. It's just they can't.
Yeah,
Like
there's
they
something
physically
going on.
cannot. I mean, like these dogs are elite, and I say that just in the highest regard. I mean, these dogs are elite.
Yeah.
They are the best at what they can do.
Same goes for the search and rescue teams. They're the very best at what they do. They put a lot of time into it. And the fact that they can't find these people, I don't think it's their fault. I think there's just some variables that we just don't know.
Yeah. Well, that actually leads us to our next point. So, investigators typically don't find tracks nine times out of 10 cases, you know? So, and if they do, they seem to stop inexplicably and lead to nowhere, as if the person just kind of vanished, you know, just poof, gone.
Yeah.
And in a lot of these cases, animal attacks are ruled out by experts because there is literally no evidence to support that. No blood, no ripped clothing, nothing.
Exactly. And you can see that in the Mel Nadell case, you know, where the tracks kind of led nowhere and people speculated, well, he was probably grabbed by a mountain lion. Well, there's no evidence of that.
Right. Well, and no gunshots were heard, nothing. Like,
yeah,
there would be some sort of dropped, you know, article of something left behind if this was a, you know, an animal predation case.
Mm-hmm. And we've covered it before, and I'm sure we'll cover it again. You know, we see that a lot, and I think we're going to keep seeing that a lot in our cases.
Oh, yeah. 100%, man. So, next bullet point here. The missing are found in areas that kind of seem difficult, but not impossible to reach by foot. And we kind of stumbled across that with Little Keith.
Yeah.
You know, we tried to track, you know, kind of like what he kind of went through, you know, with all that.
Yeah.
And we found that Les Stroud, you know, a survivalist, you know, an elite at what he does. And I'm going to bring that word back into the mix here. But an elite at surviving. You know, I mean, this dude, full-time wilderness guide, survival expert, you know, was on a hit TV series, you know, tried to make this trek of what Little Keith did. And even he says, I mean, and you guys can spot check us on this and go look at the the video online of him speaking about this case. And even he says, man, like he's a survival expert, somebody who could basically live in the woods and not have to worry. You know,
yeah.
He's like, this is tough.
Yeah, he said he couldn't see how that young kid was able to go that far away and the time that he did, you know. It didn't make any sense to him.
Right. And it's very, you know, unnerving, honestly, you know, to see a fully grown man, you know, basically, you know, who made his life career in surviving in the wilderness and teaching others how to survive in the wilderness, try to get through the same, you know, not the same exact path, but, you know, seemingly what would be, you know, the most logical path for this little guy to take. And even he's like, all right, so after like a couple hours, it gets dark. Even with a full moon, you can't see shit in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. Just look at all the points, you know. The two mountain ranges he had to cross, the distance he had to cross, which was roughly about 12 miles, the darkness out there, he could not see. You know, all of those factors came into play, and on top of the fact that there were sub-freezing temperatures that night.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Like for me, like that's just, it gives me chills thinking about that. But, you know, a very common example, you know, for a lot of these cases is, you know, children as young as like 2 to 3 years old, you know, going missing and then being found at higher elevations.
Yeah, going back,
you know,
to Jared Atadero's case.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the Jared Atadero case. I mean, he was found in a location, and Dave Palides and his cameraman actually made this trek, you know, to the top. And
yeah, he was very high up there. As I recall, 550 feet up. I'd have to double check my sources, but he was high. He definitely was.
I mean, from where they started, absolutely. Like they were very high, and you know, for you know, Jared to make that trek by himself is very questionable.
Yeah, and the
very,
experts
very questionable.
It was a mountain lion attack, and then, you know, obviously we covered that case, and the evidence had nothing that suggested it was a mountain lion attack.
Right. And to kind of coat Salanto, you know, the younger, you know, children, you know, going missing and stuff like that, you know, there are a couple cases where the children have their clothes on either backwards or inside out, and the parents claim that they can't even dress themselves.
Yeah, this is a bizarre just circumstance that, and facts of these cases. It still doesn't make any sense to me how, like you said, remember the Jared Atadero's case, you know, his clothes are actually inside out. And if it was a mountain lion, did the mountain lion pull these things, the clothes off him before he ate them?
Well, not to mention the fact that his shoes were placed literally, I mean, like, you know, a couple feet over from him, and the tooth that they actually found was on top of a log, where humus would have absolutely, you know, swallowed this tooth up.
Yeah, definitely. It was, and, you know, the shoes and the elevation, the clothing. It was a bizarre case, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, so that brings us to our next point. So the missing are usually found in an area that's been searched previously by search and rescue teams and could be, you know, once or twice. It could be numerous times. And this is over a period of days, usually a week or longer.
Yeah, you know, this is a disturbing fact, because I can see how frustrating this could be for search and rescue, and it's an extremely bizarre profile point, to say the least.
It sure is. I mean, you know, because if you really think about that, you know, they've combed the area, and these are, again, trained professionals, you know, who are out there with the intent to find somebody, you know, whether, you know, they're deceased or whether they're still living. Hopefully they're still living.
Yeah.
But these are elite professionals, you know, what they do. They're going out there with the intent to, you know, bring this person back home again, whether they're deceased or whether they're alive. And hopefully, you know, they're alive.
Yeah, and if you recall the Tom Messick case, they implemented that grid pattern search and they went shoulder to shoulder. They completely covered that area. Now think about all these search and rescue efforts where these people blanket the areas, and then days later, weeks later, the person's found in an area that they've already searched. It's frustrating.
Yeah, no, it is. And, you know, to kind of coattail onto that, you know, if the person is found in some of these cases, you know, they're actually found on the trail that's used to access the area that they're searching. You know, almost as if they're placed there intentionally, you know, so that they will be found.
Yeah, it's bizarre, you know, and some of these trails where hundreds of people walked back and forth trying to find them, and then just all of a sudden they pop up right there. It's almost as if whatever's placing these people here is taunting the search and rescue efforts.
It definitely seems like, you know, like a taunt effort, you know, kind of like a, hey, you know, you guys couldn't find him before, but, you know, here he is now. You know?
Yeah, it's bizarre to me. I don't know how to explain that one for sure.
So kind of going back to the Jared Adadero case, what I previously mentioned about his shoes. So in a lot of these cases, the shoes actually tend to go missing, either, you know, whether it be one or if it's both. You know, they're found in bizarre places in high altitudes or in like tough terrain, and the socks or the soles of their feet don't have a speck of dirt or wear on them.
Yeah.
And so going back to that Jared Adadero case, you know, I want to kind of touch bases on that, you know, because his shoes were actually removed and they were placed, you know, and if I do recall, very neatly, you know, not too far from him.
Yeah.
And, you know, after 3 years of being up on this mountain and being weathered, and they should have been worn, and there should have been some sort of, you know, weathering to them, but they were meticulous.
Yeah, they looked as if they were preserved in time almost. It's bizarre.
Yeah, it definitely was. And, you know, for me to kind of think about that, I'm like, okay, well, somebody had to have placed them there. Like there's no way in hell, you know, you're going to leave something up, you know, even down here at elevation, you know. So if I leave something outside, it's going to get weathered. You know, the sun's going to beat down on it. It's going to lose color. It's going to, there's going to be some form of weathering, you know, whether it be from the elements, you know, whether it be from, you know, animals, you know, making a nest in it or something to that kind of nature, there's going to be something that happens to it.
Yeah, and the more we look into these cases and cover them, you'll see just how shoes and socks play a part in a lot of these bizarre cases.
Yeah, and, you know, to most of the cases that we've looked into so far, I don't actually recall one that we found where the individual is actually found to be deceased. But for those cases, the cause of death is almost never determined. And I wanted to kind of touch on that for a second because, you know, I know that we've covered a lot of quote-unquote missing people.
Yeah.
We covered one that's been found, but he was fortunately found alive. You know, so,
yes.
So thank goodness for that. But we haven't covered any that were actually found to be deceased.
Yeah, and we'll get into them, definitely.
We absolutely will. But for now, we'll kind of just cover this. You know, so when they are found, you know, the medical examiners, you know, do their thing, go through their drill and everything. It's almost as if they seem to have died without a cause at all.
Yeah.
So when the medical examiners perform their, you know, their autopsies and everything, they typically, you know, write down that they died from exposure. You know, for me, it's almost like they have nothing better to write on there, you know, as opposed to, like, having evidence to support, you know, individual had a heart attack. Individual had, you know, I don't know, something else happened to them, you know.
Yeah.
Blood clot. I don't know.
I've looked into the trying to find the more information on this, and there seems to be a lot of conflicting issues when it comes to determining a cause of death for said people who are actually found. And what it's found typically is that if this happens in a small town or whatever, the coroner will give a cause of death that almost not to alarm the populace. And I've seen some cases where, like, the missing person's family will get a second opinion from another medical examiner. And then this medical examiner tells the family that there's no signs to indicate that said cause of death. So it makes you wonder, like, did they just put that on there just to kind of put it away and be done with it? Are they hiding something? I don't know.
Well, see, and that makes me think, you know, too, because, I mean, as a grieving family, you know, I don't know if I could just, you know, deal with, you know, oh, yeah, it was exposure. You know, so, right. So like, to me, so let's go back to Tom Messick. So if he was found and he was found to be deceased, you know, if I were his family, I'd be like, no, there's no way that this guy died from exposure, you know, quote unquote. You know, there's just no way. You know, yeah, if the guy had a heart attack, okay, like, that makes a lot more sense than just exposure. Because let's break that down. You know, the dude was an avid hunter, avid outdoorsman, was in the army, you know, like, really high up there, and the guy knew how to survive.
Yeah.
So how is somebody like that going to die from exposure? That makes no sense to me.
No, but I mean, you'll see that a lot in cases where the cause of death is determined to be exposure. Animal predation, when obviously the signs and the facts dictate that there was no such thing. Drowning, when they were never actually in the water. So we'll get into some more of these cases in the future, but definitely when it comes to determining a cause of death, there's something weird that, you know, it just links all these to the profile point that we're talking about here.
Yeah, and honestly, like, it's a little annoying to me. You know, how some of these cases, you know, how some of these, you know, these deaths can be mismarked intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know. You know, I mean, seemingly to me, it seems like you were saying, you know, prior, it seems like they're being mismarked for a purpose, you know, for a reason.
Yeah. And if you look back on, you know, when David Politis wanted to get a list of all the missing persons cases in our national parks, you know, he was told there is no list. Or, like, the fact that authorities aren't very cooperative with some of these search and rescue efforts. It almost seems as if either they don't want to know the truth or they're trying to actively hide it, which I don't know at this point.
Well, to that notion there, you know, go back to the Jared Adadero case, you know, where I believe it was the coroner said that he got attacked by a mountain lion.
Yeah.
And a mountain lion expert came in and was like, nah, dude, you're crazy. Like,
yeah, exactly.
There's no way.
Yeah, Jared's father hired animal predator, like, mountain lion experts to look at the facts of the case. And each one of them told him, like, your son was not killed by a mountain lion.
Which exactly.
Just, yeah. So
that just brings up the question for me, like, why? You know, why would you, you know, say this to, you know, a grieving father, you know, who clearly, you know, there was no, you know, stomach, you know, lacerations or anything like that in the jacket that they found, you know, for Jared. There was nothing to point to a medical or a mountain lion attack.
Yeah.
So why?
I don't know. No. The lack of cooperation, it makes no sense to me.
No, it doesn't. But in any sense, if the individuals are found alive, and this is kind of going back to the Keith Parkins case, they usually have memory loss about the entire event. So they don't even remember anything.
Yeah, I've seen this a lot in my research, and some of these people who are found alive, they just have no idea what happened. They have complete loss of the time frame. They were gone. They just have no way of explaining it.
Yeah, and you know, Keith Parkins is a great one to kind of revisit with, you know, for this one, because, you know, Dave Palides actually, you know, interviews him and actually sits down with him and is like, hey, like, what happened? Like, what do you remember? Yeah. And, you know, he literally doesn't remember anything. I mean, he didn't know how he got there, you know, the time frame in between, you know, to him be, you know, him leaving the barn to him being found. I mean, that was 19 hours.
Yeah.
That's a lot of time.
And it's not exclusive to just that case. I've seen that happen a few times now, and I'm sure we'll get into that in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there was actually, you know, in one of the cases that we were kind of looking into, you know, there was a toddler that went missing on a very cold night, survived, and then, you know, had a story, you know, that she had told where a wolf had fed her berries from the palm of its hand, and that's how she survived. That's the main reason why she survived.
Yeah, those are pretty bizarre, and I've seen a few of those. I saw another one where a bear took the kid into its den and took care of it. You know, kids have wild imaginations. I don't think anybody can detest against that, but they're definitely wild stories. It makes you wonder, what did these kids see out there that, you know, made them tell this story?
It definitely poses a lot of questions. I mean, you know, if I'm talking to a kid and they're like, "Oh yeah, I survived because, you know, a wolf fed me berries out of the palm of its hand." Well, one, wolves don't have hands, so what?
Yeah,
You know,
on top of the
two.
fact that these kids were missing for days and they should have been dehydrated and suffering from hypothermia, but in some cases they're found in relatively good health with no signs that they were missing at all, which just makes it even that more bizarre.
Yeah, no, and it really makes you think, you know, because like you just said, you know, hypothermia, you know, dehydration, you know, those types of, and a human can survive, you know, with dehydration for, you know, a multitude of days, but, you know, the hypothermia, that's not as forgiving.
No, definitely not.
You know, that, I mean, that could take a day or two, you know,
Yeah.
to really get somebody.
Yeah,
You know, so
it really
it's
makes
just
you
very
question.
bizarre.
Yeah, how did these kids survive out there? What exactly happened, you know, and why they came up with that story? Is there
Right.
any truth to it? Did they imagine it, or is that just their interpretation of what they saw? I don't know.
Well, and like I'm all about, you know, kids having, you know, a vivid imagination and everything like that, but you know, when it comes to something to that kind of nature where, you know, the kid goes missing, you know, somehow survives, but then claims that the only reason they survived was because of some, you know, extraordinary, you know, circumstance. It's like, what? Like,
Yeah.
I've heard some crazy stuff from kids. You know, none of which sounded anything like that. But,
No,
you know,
but
I think again too, you know, with the circumstances that they do find themselves in, you know, being lost in the woods, you know, dehydrated, you know, damn near hypothermia, I guess anything could happen.
yeah, I don't know, man. It's a weird story, and I'd like to get more information on that, but I don't know what these kids saw out there that made them tell these kind of stories.
Yeah, it's pretty wild to think about that. But you know, so a lot of these cases that we are breaking down and we're talking about and kind of researching, you know, the people who are involved typically go missing for about a week or so. But what's kind of weird is that they died a day or two prior to being found. Which then you can kind of question, you know, where were they during the time that they were missing, as well as kind of what happened to them.
Yeah, this is definitely bizarre. Because when you think of it, just think about that for a second. Because if they died only a day or two prior to being found, and they were out there multiple days, you know, you could argue that they were alive during the time the search and rescue efforts were taking place. You know, helicopters, dogs, search and rescue personnel. Why weren't these people screaming for help? Why weren't they able to be found? You know, it really makes you wonder what was going on at the time. Did they just venture that far out that they just were nowhere near in sight of the search and rescue? Who knows?
Yeah, and for me, it poses so many questions just because of the fact. I mean, a lot of the which you just covered, but you know, if they died, you know, 1 to 2 days prior to being found, why couldn't they or how, I guess, is a better way of kind of saying this, but how could they not have realized that there were people out there searching for them? I mean, you know, again, were they just so far out there that they just didn't have any sort of like notion that hey, there are people looking for me, maybe I should scream?
I don't know. I feel like this profile point might have a more bizarre explanation to it than meets the eye, because I've also, you know, trying to do research for these profile points, I've found also that sometimes people who are lost say that the reference of time kind of changes. You know, it seems sometimes when people are found, they say that the sun never went down. It was always light out when they're missing, and then they're told that they were gone for multiple days. No, which doesn't make any sense. You know, what's going on with these people that are they not around the same area? The same zone that the search and rescue efforts are taking place. I mean, we can go down some crazy theories on this one, but this one's definitely a little bizarre.
Well, and I mean, like to me, like that, like, did you enter like another world? Like, yeah. You know, it's some sort of phenomenon where, you know, where day is just like constantly day. I mean, look at Alaska. You know, Alaska has, you know, a multitude of months that are just daylight.
Yeah.
You know, so that to me is like, okay, like I get it. Like, all right. But when you're in a place like California, Colorado, you know, we have nighttime.
Yeah.
So what the hell is happening?
Yeah, and if it happened in Alaska, you know, okay, yeah, exactly. There's no reason to probe any deeper into that. But then you see these cases down here in the States where people say that these things happen to them. You know, it makes you wonder. There's also cases where people say they got lost in the woods and, you know, eventually found their way back, and they have no idea how so much time had passed from the point they were missing to when they found their way.
Yeah. Well, and like I don't know. For me, like that's just it's super strange, you know, to the point where I just don't understand it. You know,
I don't know. It's definitely a weird one. I'd like to eventually in the future get into that one, but there's a lot of cases out there about this kind of stuff. We'll have to probe deeper and try to get a better understanding of what's going on here.
Yeah, and I have no doubt in my mind that we'll cover, you know, we'll eventually cover some sort of form of this, you know, of these cases where, you know, kind of dig a little bit more deeper into it. But for now, we'll just kind of stick to the basics and go from there. But, you know, a lot of the folks that do end up on, you know, missing 411 or you know, are being researched or searched for, you know, or something to that kind of degree, you know, a lot of them are, you know, from either side of the intellectual spectrum. And what I mean by that is, you know, people who have, you know, intellectual, you know, divergencies or disabilities, or people who are working as, you know, who have a career as a scientist, a physicist, somebody of like an extremely intelligent caliber, you know, versus somebody who has, you know, like some, you know, some form of intellectual disability.
Yeah. And the physicist, that one's perplexing to me. I mean, as I recall doing research into that one pops up more frequent than you would think. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, but it's definitely something to look into. That one doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, why they go missing so often.
Well, and to that point, you know, for me, it almost feels like they're on the verge of discovering something or maybe even creating something, and somebody, whoever it is, don't know, but wants to shut them up.
Yeah.
You know, that's what that says to me, because let's think about that. You know, somebody who's that, you know, who's a physicist, who's studied that for years and who has made a career out of that, you know, or even a scientist for that matter, they go out there, you know, whatever they're doing, and we'll have to kind of, you know, do a little bit more research on, you know, some of the cases that do involve, you know, people of that caliber, you know, so we can really kind of understand what it was they were researching, what it was they were working on. But to stick to this, what I'm saying is that, you know, if they were working on something that, you know, could have been like, you know, maybe even life changer for, you know, for some people, and, you know, a certain somebody doesn't want them to, you know, to release this knowledge or this information, boom, they disappear. Oh man, we can just wipe our hands with this. Cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you look at this profile, you know, people from both ends of the intellectual spectrum, it almost seems as if some of these cases, the people are handpicked to go missing. I know that sounds weird, but that's the first thing I get from reading that.
Well, and to be honest, I think that coattails onto my point very nicely, you know, because of the fact, I mean, if they are a high profile person where they've come up with some sort of idea, or, you know, or have created something that could be essentially helpful to others. I mean, and we could dive down a huge rabbit hole with this one, to be completely honest with you.
Yeah.
But, you know, what it comes down to is like, what were these people, you know, what were they focused on? What were they exploring? What were they creating? You know, and then all of a sudden, why did they go missing?
I don't know. That's definitely an interesting profile point. And there's a lot more sub profile points that we can get into. I've heard some that people of German descent typically go missing more often than others. That, you know, that one's not as important, but I've seen some sub profile points in the future maybe we can cover, but that's just one of those.
Man, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So to kind of coattail back onto, you know, the spectrums of kind of classifying some of these cases and everything, you know, there's a physical spectrum as well that we have to kind of look at.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got cases that we've explored that, you know, where people are, you know, physically disabled. You know, look at Tom Messick, you know, had a bad knee, had one eye that he couldn't see out of.
Yeah.
Then we've got Mel Nadell.
Yeah.
Super fit.
Yeah, before he disappeared.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, Mel Nadell, you know, was a black belt. You know, guy was very fit. You know, he was an avid hunter, avid outdoorsman. So, you know, there's two sides of the spectrum here where, you know, I think personally, you know, it's either you've got a physical ailment. And in Mel Nadell's case, you know, he did have a hurt leg as well. So he was, quote unquote, physically disabled
exactly
at the time of his missing.
Yeah, because we've seen these cases where, obviously, we've already covered cases where Tom had bad knees and Mel actually hurt his knee prior to disappearing. But I've also, in my research, found that there's endurance runners, individuals who are extremely fit, you know, who hike for a living, who can cover many miles. These people also go missing and disappear, you know, so you see on both ends of the spectrum here.
But I also think another really good point, though, to kind of bring up to speed with this is that Tom, you know, in the case of like Tom versus Mel, in the sense of like having like a physical ailment, you know, Tom was 82.
Yeah.
Mel was 61. Big, big, big difference. I mean, like,
yeah,
my uncle back home, I mean, bless his heart, I mean, he's still hiking, he's still hunting. I mean, like, this dude is like an animal.
I mean,
and he's in his 80s now. You know, so it's, for me, it's like, you know, okay, I've got a hurt leg, you know, in the case of Mel. That's not necessarily going to stop me from, you know, I don't know, if I get attacked by something trying to fend for myself, you know.
Yeah. He's definitely going to fight back.
Exactly. But, you know, and then kind of flip the script here, you know, so Tom, you know, Tom Messick, 82 years old, you know, U.S. paratrooper, you know, certified badass. You know, he's got a bum leg. He's got one eye. You know, this dude's not going to, you know, I mean, in my opinion, I mean, and maybe some of our military listeners can kind of, you know, set me straight on this. But, you know, 82 years old, I mean, you're not going to, I mean, I know some tough old guys, but I mean, you know, comparing a 61-year-old to an 82-year-old, there's a big difference there.
Yeah. In Tom's case, I don't see Tom venturing too far away from where he was originally at.
No, not even slightly. I mean, that's exactly why, you know, he was in a static position, you know, to, you know, for the drive-by.
Yeah.
So just very weird points to make, you know, as far as that's concerned, but I think we've actually hit a lot of the major, you know, profile points here that we wanted to hit. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, just to kind of wrap things up, I mean, how do you feel about this? Like, this for me just kind of opens up my eyes, like tremendously.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I think it's important that we unpack this and, you know, we separate the cases that actually do get investigated for this profile and the ones that don't, because it kind of puts into perspective. Obviously, there's a lot of people that go missing every year, but We're giving you the profile points that separate that from those, and we're showing you exactly why these cases are so bizarre.
Yeah, and it's and what, you know, again, why it's so intriguing to us too, you know, because at the end of the day, I mean, you know, we're not just looking into, you know, cases that you know, fit a specific profile of being, you know, anal predation, mental health issues, so on and so forth. These are really peculiar cases that, you know, some are even still unexplained. Or actually, all of them are still unexplained. Because if they are found, they have no recollection of what happened. But, you know, it's just the cases that are just so otherworldly, you know, that just make zero sense to anybody.
Yeah. And looking at these profile points, it sets the tone for when we cover future cases, so people can see how these cases are determined and classified into such sections. But, you know, I believe there's a lot more cases that we need to cover, and I think they just get weirder and weirder.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, I'm pretty pumped up about, a couple of our next cases that we have coming up. But, I want to kind of, enlist the listeners here. And if you guys have any sort of cases that you want us to look into or anything to that kind of nature, please send us a message. You can message us on anchor.fm/thewildlyunexplained. You can hit up our Twitter. We have a Facebook and Instagram. Just search The Wildly Unexplained online. You can find our social medias on there. We'll also link them in the description. But if you do have something that you want us to look into and to really kind of, peel apart, please send it to us. Get involved with us. We'd love to have some form of contact with our listeners. Just to kind of see what you guys, have to say about it as well.
Yeah, you can send us messages. You can also actually, if you go onto our anchor.fm website, you can send us voice messages and we can incorporate them into future episodes.
Huge. So if you guys are interested in that, please feel free. But if you do like our podcast, make sure you do subscribe, wherever you do stream it. You don't want to miss an episode. And if you could, please leave a review for us. That's actually huge.
Yeah.
It kind of lets us know how we're doing, what we can do to better, these episodes for you guys. Because at the end of the day, we really want to make, quality, and resourceful information for you guys, who do choose to listen to us.
Yeah. And if you like the podcast and you would like to support more future episodes, you can give us a small donation. The contributions will allow us to get either better recording equipment, acquire more Missing 411 books to bring you better content in the future.
100%, man. Well, I think that's good for us. I'm gonna go ahead and check out here. But thank you guys again for listening to The Wildly Unexplained. I am Gary.
And I'm Danny. It was a pleasure, brother.
Check you, man.